Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Slow Burn Media, Evergreen Podcasts, and Killer Podcast presents Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless. Hello and welcome to Who Killed? The Lake Waco Murders Part 2. I'm your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media production. On this week's episode, we will be looking at the murder convictions of Munir Deeb, David Spence, and the Melendez brothers. And again, that's Melendez, not Menendez, from Beverly Hills. Now, there has been some confusion over the years about the guilt of the people convicted, and I will do my best to address those questions during this show. But before we get going, I wanted to give you guys a quick recap on the case. It was a very hot day in Texas on July 13th, 1982, when Kenneth Franks and his ex-girlfriend Jill Montgomery and her friend Raylene Rice decided to head off to Lake Waco to beat the heat. And it wasn't until Richard Franks raised the alarm, because Kenneth did not come home on time, that a search party was convened the following day. And it was during the search party where first responders recovered the bodies of the three teenagers in Spiegelville Park, which was across the lake from Cone Park. Now, for all the first responders in Waco, this was definitely a scene that they had not been used to seeing. So it was, one, gruesome, and two, young victims, as well as sexual assaults that were involved. So it was awful. I mean, this was a first responder's worst nightmare. And the bodies of the teens had been stabbed a total of 47 times. So again, like I said, this was a gruesome scene, and it was definitely one that I'm sure left a mark on a lot of the investigators at the time. Now, the investigation initially, it kind of didn't really go anywhere. And it was 8 weeks into the investigation when there were very few leads. And one lead that they did have was Terry Lee Harper, your basically local meathead with a rap sheet for assault and basically being a bully. And there were hairs recovered from the scene, but those hairs did not connect Harper or anyone else that they had been talking to. So Simmons could see that this case needed another set of eyes, or so he thought, and so he started working the case on his own time. And without a match to the hairs, the police really didn't have any concrete evidence to make any arrests. One of the great resources for this little series has been the article from the great publication Texas Monthly called The Murders at the Lake. And they state that Simmons had said that he would solve the case in a week. After convincing his higher up that he should be involved, it was just the next day that he started pulling police reports. And basically, I can't help but picture, you know, the fictional character Russ Cole, True Detective Season 1, just kind of like digging into this case and saying, I'm going to take care of this, and I'm going to, you know, it's one of those cases where I think everybody felt a personal connection to it, especially for the people that were there on the day that the bodies were found. And Simmons was no different. So Simmons believed that there must have been a lead that they had missed. And since this was 1982, it's not like they could have gone and searched in an electronic database like we have today. And assuming they collected hundreds of tips, it's kind of easy to see how one could fall through the cracks. Now, with the help of another investigator, they came across a tip from Lisa Cater, who was a 17-year-old who had lived at the Methodist home with Kenneth Franks and Jill Montgomery. Now, again, according to Texas Monthly, it was during an interview with investigators where she had fingered a man named Munir Deeb, and she said that He didn't like Kenneth and had become angry at the mere mention of his name. And this is where I think things begin to look a little off if you're just kind of looking at the case from the outside. You see, Simmons knew Deeb. He was a 23-year-old Jordanian immigrant who had run the Rainbow Drive-In, which was actually a convenience store and was across the street from the Methodist home where Montgomery and Franks had stayed at one point in time. Now, he did walk with a limp and did receive the nickname Lucky. So Simmons and his fellow investigators learned that there was some bad blood between Deeb and Kenneth. And apparently Kenneth had made some derogatory remarks about Deeb's race and made fun of his limp. And I understand that those are issues that can be concerning, but not something that I would personally see worth killing over. It turns out the true source of the conflict, and again, this is according to Texas Monthly, was a 16-year-old Methodist home resident named Gail Kelly, who had been a frequent customer of Deeb's store and someone who had been actually offered a job by Deeb. And according to the tipster, Deeb had a crush on Kelly and was not too keen on the fact that she was close with Kenneth. And understandably so, if you have a crush. Now, these, again, don't seem like reasons to order a hit on Kelly and then just take out Franks and whomever he's with in the process. I just don't see it. A witness told police that Deeb laughed when he learned of the murders, and saying that he was glad that Kenneth was dead. And again, I'm not an investigator, but this just seems pretty circumstantial because, one, nobody knows how you're going to react, and two, it could have just been an offhanded remark. How do you know? So the suspects were far and few between, and nobody will argue that these murders were senseless. But the three teenagers were killed over bad blood and a crush? Really? I mean, I know it's possible, but I don't see it as being likely, and especially considering the lack of physical evidence to the case. So it's now been nearly 40 years since the Lake Waco murders stunned the state and the city. And it was after the killings where parents kind of had to come to terms with where they were in this day and age, and they could let their kids no longer run around and feel free. And Lake Waco became, quote, that place where you just didn't go, even as teenagers. And back to the Texas Monthly article, it was after the murders, you know, I mentioned there weren't many tips that came in, but there were people calling in with leads. Now, these leads, if you're an investigator, you take with a grain of salt, because a lot of them ranged from a biker gang known as the Scorpions, where they had bragged about the killings. And then there was somebody who had seemed extremely nervous and had blood on his pants. But, you know, again, we are at the point where everybody's throwing everything they can at the wall. So what sticks is where they go to, hopefully. Some of the other crazy calls that they received were there had been Indian rituals done near the crime scene, and that this was possibly a devil's cult operating in the area. Now, again, remind you, 1982, stranger danger, satanic panic. This was all coming together. So Simmons interviewed Gail Kelly, and it was during this interview when he acknowledged to her that she looked a lot like Jill Montgomery. And now Kelly also was aware that she looked like Montgomery, so she kind of smiled and just, you know, agreed with him. And this was where things sort of began to coalesce, at least in Simmons' mind. And it was later that night that Simmons received a phone call from a distraught Kelly claiming that Deeb had confessed to her about the murders. Apparently they had been at a movie and he confessed to her after the movie. Again, if you think about this from an outside perspective, if you think he possibly did this, what are you doing going to a movie with him? Or at least he's being investigated. So as one would do, Simmons became focused on Deeb, and this is where he found the name David Wayne Spence, a.k.a. Chili. And what from Simmons was hearing on the street, this was the makings of a murder for hire plot. And Simmons believed that Spence was the ringleader of the murders, and it was Munir Deeb who was the mastermind. So Spence is arrested and tried in Waco, convicted, and then he's also tried again in Bryan, Texas, and convicted a second time, and eventually he is executed in 1997. Now, Melendez's brother, Gilbert, who also had pleaded guilty and was sentenced to two life prison terms, he died in prison in 1998 of obvious HIV complications. Now, the fourth defendant, the mastermind, quote-unquote, according to Simmons, Munir Deeb, was also sentenced to death after a trial in Cleburne, Texas. But his conviction was set aside, and Deeb was acquitted at a 1993 retrial in Fort Worth. Now, Deeb died from cancer just 6 years after being released, so it's not like he went on to enjoy a fruitful life. It's, you know, if he didn't do it, it's a shame that he died from cancer. But again, Spence and the Melendez brothers stayed in prison. And prosecutors had said that Deeb hired Spence to kill Gail Kelly so he could collect on a life insurance policy that he had placed on her as an employee. Prosecutors said at the trial that Spence screwed the job up by mistaking Jill Montgomery for Gail Kelly, hence the reason Simmons asked Kelly if she thought she looked like Montgomery. Now, they were killed because basically they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, according to authorities. Now, the prosecution said the Melendez brothers helped Spence carry out the murders as well as rape the girls, although no physical evidence connected them to the scene. Truman Simmons, the Russ Cole of Waco, Texas, left the police force and he went on to work as a sheriff's deputy. Simmons said Anthony Melendez initially denied his involvement in the murders, but it was the polygraph tests that got him, which we all know are inadmissible in court, but are still used during investigations. Now, this is where I'll stand on my soapbox for a second and just say there should be a law against pseudoscience even being allowed on suspects. So it was this point where Melendez started cooperating with investigators and said he wanted to testify against Spence because he had got him and his brother caught up, quote unquote, in the tragedy. And according to Simmons, he passed the polygraphs about those questions. Now, Melendez was then taken to where the bodies were found, and basically he was given a quiz on where everything had occurred. So Melendez pointed to a tree where Montgomery was raped and killed, and then in a subsequent search of the area that Melendez pointed out, former investigator Willie Tompkins found a bracelet buried under the leaves that matched a custom-made necklace that the girl was wearing on the day that she died. Now, the unique necklace was later returned to Montgomery's mother, who did identify it as her daughter's. And, quote, "There are just so many facts in that confession you can't get around," Simmons said. Quote, "There is no doubt that they did it." Despite Simmons' feelings, others, including Waco attorney Walter Reeves Jr., had been working to try to clear Melendez's name, even up to his death. Reeves fought on several levels to get testing done on DNA on the shoelaces that were used to tie up the victims, and those helping Melendez had hoped that the DNA evidence would prove that someone else had been responsible for the killings. But it was after the evidence was transferred to several labs around the country and nothing definitive has been reported from the testing, I'm going to say that since that was in an article from, 3 years ago, that there still is either nothing to say or they just are keeping it to themselves. If they had any evidence to say that they didn't do it, I'm sure his lawyers would be standing out in front of the courthouse with the test results. Now, they did hope that Melendez would be set free and they would be able to collect on a huge payday from the state when he was exonerated. But they did also think that it might prove that Spence was not guilty since he was put to death by the state. Now, the former prosecutor of the Lake Waco cases, Vic Fiesel, he kind of has a a law office in Waco and Austin, and basically he was trying to clear their names. And it was interesting just to see where he went. And quote, anyone who's read the real transcripts, or the trial transcripts, I should say, would know better and wouldn't give this story the time of day, Wiesel said. And this is what the Boston Globe had to say about capital punishment in this day and age. Quote, after more than a century of trying, we have still not managed to find a way of killing that does not run the risk of violating our most important moral and constitutional commitments. It is possible to see this as a simply a failure of ingenuity, one that might be solved by the next clever execution technique. The story of America's enforcement of the death penalty suggests another answer as well, that in practice, such a method simply does not exist, unquote. So with that being said, I believe it is important to hear how they came to that conclusion. Luckily, the University of Michigan Law School did a write-up about the case of Munir Deeb. And the reason I just read the excerpt from the Globe article basically was just to remind everybody that the death penalty does remove any chance of overturning a wrongful conviction, because no prosecutor wants to believe that they put an innocent person to death. So whether or not Munir Deeb was guilty, he was found to be innocent in a retrial in 1993. And I want to read this whole legal article from the Michigan Law School, and I will limit any legalese throughout to make it easy to ingest. But basically, it's important for the listeners to understand how somebody who was thought to be the mastermind was eventually cleared. And so here we go. On July 14th, 1982, the bodies of three teenagers were found slashed and stabbed to death in a park near Lake Waco in Waco, Texas. Raylene Rice, 17, and Jill Montgomery, 18, were nude with their hands tied behind their backs. Both had been raped, slashed, and stabbed multiple times. Kenneth Franks, 18, was fully clothed and had been stabbed at least 20 times. Rice's car was found at another nearby park where the three had told Frank's father they were going the night before. At the time, police said the murders were among the most gruesome ever committed in Central Texas. The case went unsolved for several weeks. In the late summer of 1982, Truman Simmons, a narcotics investigator in the McLennan County Sheriff's Department, asked to be put in charge of the case. Simmons' work on the case, as well as another murder in Waco 4 years later, would become the subject of criticism for his use of jailhouse informants. Ultimately, three men convicted of murder following investigations by Simmons would be exonerated. He almost immediately focused on 23-year-old Munir Deeb, a Jordanian immigrant who operated a convenience store in Waco. Simmons had developed a theory that Deeb contracted the murder of one of his employees, Gail Kelly, because she had rejected his advances and was dating Franks. Because Kelly bore a striking resemblance to Montgomery, Simmons believed that the murders had been a case of mistaken identity. Deeb had taken out a $20,000 life insurance policy on Kelly, as he did for all his employees. Kelly had named Deeb the beneficiary of her policy. Simmons found witnesses, including Deeb's business partner, who said that Deeb made comments after the murders that they deserved to be killed, although Deeb had said after making the statements that he was joking. Deeb was arrested on September 13, 1982, and was held in custody for 5 days. He was released after passing a 3-hour polygraph examination. During this time, Simmons arrested three other men for the murders: David Wayne Spence and Gilbert and Anthony Melendez. He claimed that Deeb had agreed to pay $5,000 to Spence to kill Kelly, and that when the defendants saw Franks with the two young women, one of whom resembled Kelly, at Cone Park, they abducted them, leaving Rice's car behind, and took them to Spiegelville Park, where the murders occurred. Deeb was arrested again on November 14, 1983, and was indicted for Montgomery's murder. The trial was moved to Johnson County due to the publicity of the case. At the trial, Deeb testified in his own behalf and denied any involvement in the murders. In rebuttal, the prosecution called Daryl Beckham, an inmate who testified that he had numerous conversations with David Spence at the McLennan County Jail. Beckham said that Spence told him Deeb was angry because Franks and Kelly were romantically linked and that he had to do something about it. Beckham said Spence said Deeb hired him to kill Kelly. On June 30th, 1985, Deeb was convicted and sentenced to death. The Melendez brothers pled guilty and testified against Spence, and they were tried separately. They received life prison terms. Spence was also convicted and sentenced to death. In late February 1986, Spence's mother, Juanita White, received a letter from one of the inmates who testified against Spence, apologizing for lying. She contacted Spence's lawyer, who told police. Now, this is not in the article, but in a tragic turn of events, on the morning of March 2nd, 1986, White was found raped and beaten to death in her home. Now, police arrested Joe Sidney Williams, 19, and Calvin Washington, 30, the following day after police said they were in possession of Juanita White's car. Williams was tried first and was convicted on June 20th, 1987. He was sentenced to life in prison. Washington was convicted on December 11th, 1987, and was also sentenced to life in prison. In the meantime, Deeb, in prison, began studying the law, and he would later become a licensed paralegal. In June 1991, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals overturned his conviction. The court ruled that certain testimony was inadmissible hearsay and should not have been admitted against Deeb at all in his trial. In November 1991, Waco Police Officer Jan Price, who was initially assigned to be the lead investigator in the White murder, gave a sworn statement saying that she believed that Washington and Williams were innocent. In her statement, Price said that after White's body was found and police finished their investigation at her home, the house was secured. But a neighbor reported that the house was broken into after police left. And when Price investigated, she found that whoever broke into the house had ransacked White's personal papers, which were kept in the bedroom that Spence used when he still lived with his mother. Price said that within weeks of White's murder, she developed a suspect, a man named Benny Carroll, who, not long after White was sexually assaulted and killed, had committed a similar crime in the same neighborhood. She said that when she told prosecutors in the McLennan County District Attorney's Office about her investigation, she was told that Simmons was in charge of the White murder. Price also said in her affidavit that she later learned that Simmons had cut a deal with a jail inmate for his immediate release in return for attempting to get Washington to make incriminating statements. She said her investigation turned up evidence that Simmons routinely met with jail inmates in the district attorney's office and fed them information to help them fabricate false statements and present them as the truth. Quote, "I was convinced that Simmons' investigation included numerous promises to jail inmates and the outright fabrication of evidence against the unlucky suspects Calvin Washington and Joe Sidney Williams," Price said in the affidavit. On October 14, 1992, the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals set aside Williams' conviction, ruling that testimony was improperly admitted at his trial. He was released from prison and the charges were dismissed on June 30, 1993. Now, Deeb went on trial a second time and was acquitted on January 12, 1993. Just 4 years later, David Wayne Spence, still proclaiming his innocence from the gurney, was executed. DNA tests on hairs found on the terry cloth strips used to bind the hands of Montgomery and Rice eliminated Spence as well as the Melendez brothers. Meanwhile, Washington continued to fight to prove his innocence and obtained a court order for DNA testing of the evidence in the case. In 2001, the test concluded that the blood on the shirt found at his home was not the victim's, as had been asserted at his trial. Now, DNA tests on the semen recovered from White's body excluded both Washington and Williams. Instead, the semen was linked to Benny Carroll, who committed suicide in 1990. So Washington was released from prison on July 5th, 2001, was pardoned by Rick Perry on October 9th of that year, and later received compensation. So again, that was done by Maurice Posley of the University of Michigan Law School. Now, the reason why I threw those other cases in there was to give you another idea or perspective on who Truman Simmons really was or is as far as an investigator goes. And it's not to say that he's right or wrong. It just looks like he may have used some misinformation to get some convictions that weren't necessarily on the up and up. So after Deeb was found not guilty, this kind of opened up the floodgates for the possibility that none of the four men were actually guilty. And that led to the next stage of the case, which was lawsuits. According to KCEN-TV, the sons of David Wayne Spence, who was convicted and sentenced to death for two of the three homicides that made up the 1982 Lake Waco murders, filed a lawsuit against the state of Texas. The sons claim their father and the other three suspects in the case were all innocent. I'm going to read directly from the article here. Quote, "The state of Texas, by and through its employees, agents, and representatives, withheld evidence, destroyed evidence, coerced untruthful confessions, utilized junk science, bribed witnesses, fraudulently concealed the foregoing, and knowingly convicted not one but four individuals," argues the lawsuit, which was filed in the Travis County District Court. So brothers Gilbert and Anthony Melendez took plea bargains in the case. But the lawsuit claims that their confessions were coerced, untrue, and have since been recanted. Now, Munir Deeb, who prosecutors painted as, again, the mastermind, was found, quote, not guilty after initially being sentenced to death. Now, this is from the article, quote, "It is intellectually inconsistent and dishonest to convict David, Gilbert, and Tony when Deeb, the purported mastermind, was in fact not guilty," unquote, the lawsuit states. Dallas-based attorney Jay English, who is representing the Spence sons, claims David maintained his innocence until his execution in 1997. The lawsuit claims tapes recorded in McLennan County District Attorney Vic Vizel's office reveal prosecutors leaked evidence and colluded with court-appointed defense attorneys. The lawsuit demanded compensation for wrongful imprisonment, attorney fees, and full pardons for the defendants. While the lawsuit was being filed, the city of Waco was still convinced they had their men. Waco is a city that is only a few hours from any of the major states' metropolitan areas. The citizens of Waco feel pretty safe because of this, but the Lake Waco murders definitely changed their lives forever. In 1982, with Waco's population hovering just around 100,000, they felt like the chances of having multiple killers looming in the area was just a stretch, and it was a stretch for law enforcement to believe that. They figured these four men committed the three senseless murders of teenagers in their primes because how many murderers are really living in Waco? Everyone likes to focus on the four men convicted early on, but like I mentioned earlier in the episode, there was one suspect in this case, and that was the local man named Terry Harper. Several witnesses had told police that Mr. Harper had bragged about the killings before the bodies were even found and before news stories regarding the murders had actually aired. Now, the witnesses claimed that Mr. Harper had even offered details that even some law enforcement officials did not know, mentioning, for example, that one of the victim's nipples had been severed in the attack. Roughly 20 witnesses saw either the victims or their car in Cone Park on the night of the murders. Many mentioned seeing Mr. Harper with the victims. Seven witnesses reported that Harper had told them of his involvement in the murder, and at least three said he had made those statements before the murders were reported to the media. Harper refused to cooperate with the police, who nonetheless decided that he was untrustworthy as a suspect because he had previously and untruthfully bragged about being involved in other murders. Understandable, but still probably deserved another look. Now, this led Spence's lawyers to later question him, where he denied his involvement and signed an affidavit stating that he was actually at home watching the television program Dynasty during the murders. However, Dynasty wasn't shown that night. And as we know, this was 1982. There was no such thing as a DVR. It wasn't even on the horizon. So if it was in the TV guide, then it happened. So Harper's dynasty alibi, the police used to dismiss him as a suspect, was bunk. So it was a tip that started the ball rolling towards Deeb's corner. Her statement to police may have carried some racial overtones that may have been missed or just brushed off when she spoke with police. She called Munir Deeb the Arab man, who also went by the nickname Lucky. And this being the 1980s in Texas, he ran a convenience store. So it was kind of stereotypical at that day and age. Again, as I mentioned, this convenience store was located across the street from the Methodist home where Kenneth Franks and Jill Montgomery had once stayed. Now, this tipster had said that they had heard that Deeb say that, quote, he'd like to put Kenneth Franks in the hospital. Now, Franks had allegedly ridden his motorcycle through Deeb's store parking lot, yelling racial epithets and giving Deeb the middle finger. Understandably, that would be a reason to be mad at this guy. In the book, Careless Whispers, the author says the tipster told police Deeb and Franks didn't like each other. She said it had something to do with Gail, as I mentioned before, and that she and Kenneth were good friends and Lucky didn't like that one bit. She told the author, quote, I think he wanted Gail to be his girlfriend. Deeb was also described being, quote, a lot smaller than Kenneth. I remember telling him at the time that I didn't think he was capable of putting anybody in the hospital. The idea of him even getting into a fist fight was pretty funny, really, unquote. The officer wrote up the tip and the investigation continued to churn without much to show for it. The last of the four defendants was Anthony Melendez, and he died in prison in 2017, and he was serving two life prison terms for the murders. Now, he died as his ex-wife and Vic Fizel were working to exonerate him, and even though those efforts had stalled in the past, they were still working to get his name cleared. Again, Melendez had pleaded guilty to two counts of murder in the case and testified against David Wayne Spence at his trial in Bryan, and they also petitioned the governor for a reprieve, commutation, or pardon after he recanted his confession. So with all of that being said, I am just left a little bit confused about the case, just to be honest with you. The likeliest suspects are probably the ones that were convicted. But if you're going to speculate on what could have been said at trial or what could have been brought up as far as, you know, quickly brushing off Terry Harper as being a possible suspect in the case, I just, you know, I think if they went back and they retried the case again today, especially with the lack of DNA evidence. I know it was 1982, so that wasn't even something that was, you know, feasible. But I think if they went back and they looked at this particular homicide, and yes, this is a horrible, horrible, horrible crime that should have never, ever happened to these poor three teenagers. After reviewing this case for the past couple weeks, I kind of am left with the belief that Harper should have been investigated more. The confessions given by the Melendez brothers should have been maybe examined a little bit closer to see if they actually matched the evidence. I understand that they were able to find a piece of Montgomery's necklace near the crime scene that Melendez pointed out where one of the rapes occurred. But again, they took them to the crime scene where the murders happened. So the chances of finding something there were pretty high. I would say that doesn't look very good for the law enforcement agents who missed that piece of evidence during their initial examination of the crime scene. But again, I think that is not something that could have been used or should have been used against him. They took him to the crime scene. They kind of fed him the information. Then they testified against Deeb and Spence. And, well, you know, again, if Deeb is not guilty, how are these other guys guilty? And why would they be involved in the murder of these three teenagers? So you definitely have a lot of questions. And I think this is really one of those cases where if evidence really came out that David Wayne Spence was innocent, we may never hear it because, again, no prosecutor wants to be held accountable for putting somebody to death who is an innocent man. That is my opinion, and my opinion only. Again, this is definitely a case that would be treated differently in 2020, and I can only hope that with the advances in technology that we've had over the years, that we can prevent innocent people from being put to death if those punishments are in place. So again, that's the number one thing that comes out of this to me, is that if Spence was innocent, there's nothing we can do about it because he was executed 23 years ago. And that's a shame because he may have been a bad guy, but if he didn't commit these murders, then he was put to death as an innocent man. So again, thank you guys so much for listening. And I really appreciate you guys listening to part two of the Lake Waco murders. Thank you again to this week's very timely sponsor of Who Killed, the Coronavirus Daily Briefing Podcast from Ride Home Media. Guys, go and subscribe today wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And as always, thank you guys for tuning in to this week's episode. If you do enjoy this independently produced podcast and would like to help keep this show on the air, you can support the show by clicking on the donate button within the show notes or on the left-hand side of slowburnmedia.com. That is slow minus the W. Or via the Venmo app with my username at bill-huffman-3. Any amount is appreciated and it really does help keep this podcast running. You can also support the show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This will help keep the important cases I cover in the spotlight. For those of you planning on attending CrimeCon in May, I am planning on attending as well, and I will be on Podcast Row representing all of my Slow Burn Media shows, my passion case, Who Killed, and Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic. Now, I know the situation at the moment is changing daily, so I'm not exactly sure what will happen. But if you do want to save on a ticket, which I should say is refundable, you can use my promo code AMY2020 for 10% off. And again, that is AMY2020. And for those of you who would like to stay up to date on the cases that I have covered, as well as the new shows that I have coming down the pipeline, you can follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. If you are new to the show, all of my previous episodes are available for free wherever you get your favorite podcast. If you have any information on any of the cases I have featured, you can always submit a tip via Crime Stoppers, and you can do it anonymously, crimestoppers.com, or you can contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. Pretty much all you have to do is tell them the case that you have information about, and they will pretty much direct you where you need to go and will hopefully get you in at least a voicemail box of some place where you can leave your tip. So you guys, thanks again for listening this week. And as always, until next time, be safe.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth. And together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.